From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet two important artists from abroad. Bapsi Sidhwa is one of Pakistan's most popular novelists. She's also a women's rights activist, challenging the rigidly defined roles of women in her country. Also, Dutch composer, musician, and band leader Willem Bruycker. His music has the adventurousness of the avant-garde and the comedy of vaudeville. We'll talk with Bruycker and review his latest record. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Jewish settlers have announced the establishment of a new community in the Israeli-occupied territories. The announcement comes one day before the opening of the Madrid Peace Conference. Linda Gradstein reports.
150 women and 50 children today moved into the new settlement of Rachela. It was established at the site of yesterday's armed attack on a bus of Jewish settlers and is named after Rachel Druk, a mother of seven killed in the attack. The mayor of the Jewish residents of the West Bank city of Hebron, Yechiel Leiter, told reporters in Madrid that new settlements are the only response to violence.
Every stone cast against us will be the foundation for a new Jewish home. Every tree burnt will be replaced by 10.
Leiter also said that tomorrow construction would begin on a new neighborhood of Shiloh, the settlement where Druk lived. Palestinians, on the other hand, are likely to protest. They say all settlement activity must stop before there can be peace. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Madrid.
Guerrillas in South Lebanon have stepped up their attacks on Israeli soldiers on the eve of the Middle East Peace Conference. The Israeli army said that three of its soldiers were killed and six were wounded in separate attacks in the 10-mile strip of Lebanese land that Israel patrols as a security zone. The killings came just a day after two Israelis were killed and five wounded in an ambush on a bus in the occupied West Bank. Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir told reporters in Madrid that the violence would not deter Israel from taking part in the peace conference. The Senate is moving toward passage of the latest version of a civil rights bill. The measure would reverse several Supreme Court decisions that make it more difficult for victims of discrimination to sue their employers. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Today, Congress struggled to work out another compromise on an amendment that would apply the civil rights laws to Congress itself. Senate leaders spent most of the day behind closed doors trying to hammer out an agreement that would extend the protections of the civil rights bill to employees of the Senate and the White House. In the past, this proposal has been rejected as a violation of separation of powers because it would allow employees of one branch of government to take their complaints to another branch. But now, with public disgust at Congress growing, members of the Senate are anxious to show that they live and work by the same rules as everyone else. The proposal would allow Senate employees and White House staff to file job complaints with a special review board with the opportunity to appeal to a federal court of appeals judge. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Stock prices were up for the second day in a row today as government figures showed a surge of third-quarter growth in the gross national product. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 16 points to finish the day at 3,061.9. Advances led declines by a margin of 5-3 in heavy trading of 193 million shares. This is NPR. With just a week to go before the special senatorial race in Pennsylvania, polls show former Attorney General Dick Thornburgh about even with a comparative outsider. Harris Wofford was appointed to fill the vacancy left by the death of Senator John Heintz, and at the beginning of the campaign, he trailed Thornburgh by more than 30 points. Wofford, a Democrat, has tried to appeal to middle-class voters with a call for tax cuts, national health insurance, and control of government privileges. Thornburgh is a former two-term Republican governor who's had strong support from President Bush. Analysts say that if Thornburgh loses, it could show the president himself is vulnerable on domestic issues. President Bush cut off almost all commercial transactions between the United States and Haiti today. The order is meant to pressure the country's military rulers to restore democracy to the Caribbean island nation. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The Organization of American States earlier this month approved a resolution calling for a hemisphere-wide embargo against Haiti. The OAS, with the administration's support, is demanding Jean-Bertrand Aristide be restored as Haiti's president. He was ousted in a coup September 30th. According to a White House statement issued in Madrid, the president included the overthrow of Aristide poses an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, foreign policy, and economy of the U.S. Officials say the order does not pertain to certain shipments of food. Haiti is the hemisphere's poorest country and is heavily dependent on outside support for its food needs. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
A House Ethics Subcommittee said today that it will reconstruct the account histories of lawmakers who may have abused House banking privileges, but won't immediately identify those who wrote bad checks. The panel's chairman, New York Democrat Matthew McHugh, said that the reconstructions would enable him to recommend individual investigations of any members who are suspected of violating House rules. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is a women's rights activist from a country where many women see the world around them from behind a veil. Bapsi Sidhwa has been a social worker in Pakistan and was her country's representative to the Asian Women's Congress in 1975. This year, she received the highest honor Pakistan bestows on a civilian. Sidhwa is also one of Pakistan's most popular novelists and one of the first to be published internationally. Her latest book, Cracking India, has just been published in the States by Milkweed Editions. It's set in the late 40s, after England pulled out of India and the country was divided into predominantly Hindu India and predominantly Muslim Pakistan. Sidhwa was 9 at the time of the partition, and she remembers the atmosphere of violence and betrayal as Muslims, Hindus, Parsis, and Sikhs fought among themselves. As a Parsi, she was part of a minority group. The Parsi religion has under 500,000 followers in the whole world. The novel is semi-autobiographical, told from the perspective of a young Parsi girl. Here's a short reading.
There is much disturbing talk. India is going to be broken. Can one break a country? And what happens if they break it where our house is? Or crack it further up on Waris Road? How will I ever get to Godmother's then? I ask cousin. Rubbish, she says. No one's going to break India. It's not made of glass. I ask Aya. They'll dig a canal, she ventures. This side for Hindustan and this side for Pakistan. If they want two countries, that's what they'll have to do. Crack India with a long canal. Gandhi, Jinnah, Nehru, Mountbatten are names I hear. And I become aware of religious differences. It is sudden. One day, everybody is themselves. And the next day, they are Hindu, Muslim, Sikh, Christian. People shrink, dwindling into symbols. Aya is no longer just my all-encompassing Aya. She's also a token, a Hindu.
Were you frightened when the country was partitioned?
As a child, I have memories of chants, of mobs chanting in the distance, which were very threatening sounds. I felt they threatened the people I held dear. And I saw fires. It wasn't like a fire display to me. It really was threatening. It was like blood was splashed in the sky. And, of course, all the time there was talk around me of what was happening to our friends and neighbors who were at that time Hindu and Sikh who were leaving and new refugees arriving. And I saw dead bodies on my Waris Road where I lived.
That's pretty terrifying.
As a child, yes, these sounds more than anything else terrified me.
In your novel, Cracking India, Aya, who is the nursemaid of the main character, the woman who cares for the child, she is kind of destroyed at the end by Muslims because she is a Hindu in Muslim Pakistan. Did you know people who were in that position, people who were close to you?
Not people who were close to me, but I grew up with stories about what happened to so-and-so's sister, mother, daughter, brother, father. Now, these were accounts recited by Muslim refugees because I was in Lahore. What did happen, one of the most terrible aspects of the partition was that hundreds of thousands of women were kidnapped, Hindu women and Sikh women by Muslims and Muslim women by Hindus and Sikhs. It's sort of very true of our part of the world that when you have to celebrate a victory, the victors do so on the body of a woman. And when you want to get rid of the feeling of humiliation at a defeat, there again you humiliate your enemy's women by raping them, etc. So the women were the major targets when it came to power play, humiliation, and celebration in this part of the world. So it was Hindu, Muslim, Sikh women, all of who suffered.
When you say they were kidnapped, where were they taken?
They were kidnapped by individuals, taken into their homes, raped, and then sold for 10 rupees each, 20 rupees each, which is less than a dollar, you know. People would be shouting in the streets, apparently, that zanana for sale, zana for sale. You know that women are being sold, and that's the price, 10 rupees for a woman.
When you became a woman, did you meet women who had been kidnapped and sold years before?
I may have met them, but, you know, this is something, it's considered so dishonorable and so defiling that women would not openly talk about it. Other women would whisper about it. And as a child, I would just catch innuendos and whispers about various women. Where I was living, right next door to me, was a camp for recovered women. These were the women who were kidnapped and then recovered after the partition from various places and brought to these camps. And we as children used to go onto our roof and peek into this camp and look at these very despondent, very poor sort of looking women who didn't talk much. I mean, now with my adult's imagination, I can understand what happened to them. But as a child, I couldn't grasp it. And the sad thing was that a lot of these women were not accepted back by their families because women are supposed to embody honor. You know, they're vessels for honor. And they had been dishonored, so the families didn't want them back into their households. And they were left to fend, you know, by a little training in embroidery and to eke out their lives like that.
You were married at the age of 19. You had three children. You've described yourself as having been an upper middle class housewife. Your husband was a businessman. How did you start becoming involved with women's rights?
This is very strange, actually. I read this book, The Female Eunuch, by Germaine Greer. This must be when I was about 25, 26. And I just got up the next day, a totally different person, very aggressive, fighting with my husband, having temper tantrums all around, you know, till I decided I shouldn't read books like that. But that gave me an awareness of, well, why was I so submissive and why was I so accepting of taking the secondary place and being so subservient to other people, whether it was my father, mother, or husband. And then I got involved in social work, and gradually my interest in what was happening to women developed, and also my awareness of what was happening to women. I started doing a lot of social work with destitute women's homes, with orphanages, and there I came across instances which really sort of left their stain on me, and I wanted to do something about it.
When you say that you were tired of being subservient to your parents and to your husband, what was the typical middle-class marriage like in Pakistan or at the time? When you talk about subservience, what do you mean?
Well, you know, you are always waiting for your husband. You're more or less a public relations officer to your husband, entertaining for him all the time, taking phone calls. If you go out in a car, you're the one who's waiting endlessly for him to do his work and come in. And you take everything in your stride. You're told this evening so many people are coming, or this day so-and-so is coming, or keep the house ready, we're expecting so many visitors, or at the drop of the hat, let's travel. I mean, you totally sort of sublimate your life for your husband's existence, before that for your parents' existence. These are very little things, and they're not very demanding, but in the end they accumulate and make for a great demand on one's time.
When you started working with destitute women, did you start becoming aware of the class differences in how women were treated in your country?
Yes, the class difference is there enormously. Among the very poor, the women don't observe the veil, And they work in the fields with the men, except, of course, the village leader's wife. She would observe parda. And her work is not really accounted for in terms of cash. You know, it's free labor. And then when they enter the middle class, interestingly enough, at this point, the woman says, okay, now I'm better off, so I'll go in behind the veil. I'll wear a veil. So it is a status symbol that now my wife does not need to work. We are better off. Then as you get to the much richer classes, then it is the women are, they don't observe the veil, except if they're in very narrow-minded villages, if their husbands happen to be in the mountain villages, you know, sardars or lords out there. And these women have more or less the freedom of a wife in America, perhaps. So the class does make a great difference. And then when I was working in the destitute women's homes, that's when I became aware what had happened. And it's a strange thing that in Pakistan, men outnumber the women. And in these destitute women's, in the home I was working, there were a lot of women with children. By 19, a woman has produced perhaps 4 children. And if there were 25 women in the home, there would be about 300 men wanting to marry them. And once or twice I realized that perhaps there was something wrong going on because I saw a dwarf and a very sort of cruel-looking man getting married to a very beautiful young woman of 19. And after that, my friends and I decided that we would interview each of the bridegrooms before something like that happened. And we would interview the bridegrooms to find out what they wanted to marry for. Most of them said, oh, you know, we have so many chickens, we have so many goats, we have so many sacks of wheat, and we have nobody to look after it because my wife died. And then we'd say, but you don't want a wife, you just want a free servant. And if a man showed some inclination to romance, that, look, I've had nobody to arrange my marriage because I've been busy for this reason or that reason, and I would like to get married and have a home of my own, then we would introduce the woman, or at least let them have a look at each other and arrange a marriage between them.
Did you ever wear the veil yourself?
Just as a teenager once, to see what it felt like, I borrowed the veil of one of my friend's mothers, and I walked on the street. It was a sort of an adventure.
So how did it feel?
Well, you know, it's a black thing, and you wear it from top to bottom. You wear it like a skull cap over the head, and it flows right down to your feet. And you feel a little cramped, and it's mysterious because there's netting in front, and you look out through that. The world does seem a little hazier. Your movements are constricted. It certainly, I think, shifts you into a different dimension, into a different world, a more cramped world, constricted world.
Do you see religion as an anti-feminist force in Pakistan?
Not the religion itself, but the way it is practiced and the way the mullahs and particularly the fundamentalists interpret it. Sometimes I feel they use religion as something with which to browbeat women and make them more subservient. God knows they're subservient enough, and still they're not satisfied. And they certainly use religion to do so. But a lot of Pakistani women feel they ought to interpret religion according to their lights, and the Quran according to their lights, and they feel they'd come up with a different interpretation.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bapsi Sidhwa. She's a Pakistani writer, one of Pakistan's most popular writers, and her latest novel, Cracking India, has just been published in the United States. We'll take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Pakistani novelist and women's rights activist Bapsi Sidhwa is my guest. You've explained how you went from being a middle-class homemaker to being a women's rights advocate. How did you become a writer? How did you start writing?
Right, I came across it very accidentally. I'd never written before. And when I was about 28, 29, I visited a remote part of Pakistan in the Karakoram Mountains, which is under total tribal jurisdiction. And the tribes there are so locked into the mountains that they really live in the Stone Age still. They literally live in caves. And I heard the story of a young girl who had been married there and had run away from her husband. And these people think a runaway, if a wife runs away, it's an intolerable insult to the husband. And the whole clan was out hunting her, and eventually, these infallible hunters, and they found her near the Indus River just before she could be rescued, and they severed her head from her body. When I heard the story in this very beautifully spectacular country in the northern areas, when I came back to Pakistan, I wanted to tell the story of this girl because it did reflect the lives of quite a few women in a way. And I did want to describe the beauty of the scenes I'd seen and the tribals. I mean, they were a very romantic people in a way. And I sat down to write what I thought was a short story. And before I knew it, it was turning into a novel, and it became my first novel, which was called The Bride and now is known as The Pakistani Bride.
You live part of the time in Pakistan and part of the time in the United States.
Yes, lately yes. I've been doing that.
Is it hard to get your work known outside of your country? I know, for instance, your new novel, Cracking India, was first published in England, or at least it was published in England before it was published in the States. Uh-huh. Is it hard to get your work known internationally?
Oh, very hard. If you're living in Pakistan and you write in English, I think I'm the very first to be published abroad, or maybe among the very few. I'd written both the novels, The Pakistani Bride and The Crow Eaters. And although they were accepted by Curtis Brown in America, they were at that time agents, the poor people showed it around to every publisher for about 3 years. And also they sent it to their agents in Britain. And both the books were getting rejection slips, any amount of rejection slips from both sides of the Atlantic. And it was a heartbreaking process for me. I stopped writing for about 6 years in between. So before I could get published, it had taken about 10 years for me to be published abroad. Before that, I was published in Pakistan. And then I was published in Britain and then in America.
Is there a sense among publishers abroad, well, who cares about Pakistan? Who understands Pakistan? Our readers won't want to know.
Precisely. That's what most of the rejection slips said, that though we love the work, we feel Pakistan is too remote in time and space, and who will be interested in it? Unfortunately, in our very competitive market, we don't feel the book will be monetarily, helpful. It won't make money.
What do you have a large readership in Pakistan, proportionately?
A very large readership. I would be considered in the absolute bestseller racket. I've had the honor of being pirated, and they're very peculiar versions of my books floating around. I don't mind because they sell cheap and they're read, so I'm quite happy.
Are they controversial in your country?
We were expecting The Bride to be controversial, but it wasn't for some reason. And that is why The Crow Eaters was published first, because it was mainly a comedy about the Zoroastrians, which tell you everything about my community as well. But that is the novel which became very controversial. My community took great exception to it. They felt I'd let out secrets that I shouldn't have, and they felt threatened because they were a minority. And it's strange because I'd written it out of great affection. But now that I've received from Pakistan what is a very high civilian award called the Sitara-e Pakistan, my community suddenly accepts me and my writing, You need somebody else to accept you, and then your own community accepts you.
Right, because then you make them look good.
Yeah, maybe. At one point, not so good, and then suddenly good.
What are the things about the status of women that you would still like to see changed in Pakistan?
Oh, my God, a lot of things, most of the things. I would like them, first of all, to get education, to get more control of money, more control of their lives. I certainly would like to see any brother, husband, or father who kills his wife to be just hung. I mean, I'm absolutely for capital punishment when it comes to that. because brothers and fathers think it is their right, you know, to if they feel their sister is flirting or has had a secret affair, even with her fiancé, they feel quite justified in killing her. This is, of course, again, we are talking of a class, the peasant class, the poorer classes. And just every sort of zulm, now I'm trying to think, every sort of bullying tactic is used on women, and women are supposed to accept it. And I think I would like to see a lot changed.
Any impressions of the women's movement in the United States?
Yes, of course. I've experienced it, but it's a totally different breed of feminist movement here. Their priorities are different, and their way of handling issues are different. I think there's this huge cultural difference which makes us to react to different things in different ways.
What do you see as the main difference between how the American women's movement handles issues as compared to what you're used to?
It seems to me that they have probably resolved some issues and their priorities have shifted to things which, at this point, because our problems are so enormous, seem to us a little trivial. And we want to be fighting for things where women are in constant physical danger, physically being kidnapped from many parts of the countries to be used in prostitution. And the society turns a blind eye towards it. Whereas some of the issues like, I do want to really name them because I don't know in what context they fit into the American woman's consciousness. But I know there are some serious problems women face here and they have to keep struggling against it too.
Kidnapping is still an issue in Pakistan?
Yes, because not only kidnapping, but in the northern areas, the races are very white, pale-colored, and they're extremely poor. So people buy girls there, and they put them into prostitution or, you know, all sorts of slavery and things like that. So that is the form of kidnapping. There are other forms of kidnapping, too. I mean, women, for some reason, because of the segregation in the society or whatever the factor, they are, in a way, a desirable commodity. It's the opposite of India, where a woman pays a dowry to get married. In Pakistan, the husband pays the bride's father, this is in the northern areas of Pakistan, to get a bride. So a woman is like a commodity. She's worth money. So women are kidnapped for several reasons.
Are you still married, by the way?
Yes, I am.
Has it been hard to change so much and keep a marriage together?
We've come to a comfortable relationship. Of course, the marriage pattern did change several times, and particularly after we moved to the States. But I think, you know, living in the society we did in Pakistan, naturally a lot of the values of Pakistan had been absorbed, which could not be sustained in America, where the atmosphere for a woman is a lot freer. And I chafed at some of the things. And my husband also changed a lot of his thinking in this different atmosphere. And we have come down to a much more comfortable relationship.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Bepsy Seedwa's novel Cracking India has just been published in the United States by Milkweed Editions. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're listening to music by the Willem Bruyker Collectief. Bruyker's influences are as diverse as Louis Armstrong and Edgar Varèse. His stage style is part guerrilla theater, part vaudeville. Willem Bruyker is the Netherlands' most popular jazz export, and he's currently on an American tour. Coming up, we talk with Bruyker and review his latest record. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Israel launched two air strikes in southern Lebanon after yesterday's attacks on its soldiers. Those earlier attacks were led by fundamentalist guerrillas opposed to the Middle Eastern peace talks. Hillary Brown reports from Jerusalem.
The Israelis said tonight that the Air Force bombed the headquarters of the Hezbollah, the pro-Iranian Party of God, in Nabatea in South Lebanon today, following an attack this morning which killed three Israeli soldiers. Their armored car was blown up by a remote-controlled bomb. The Hezbollah claimed responsibility. Hours before, Israeli troops were attacked while on patrol in another part of Israel's self-declared security zone in South Lebanon. Five soldiers were wounded. The Israelis said two attackers were killed and one captured in the gun battle that followed. This afternoon, the Israelis attacked the Palestinian refugee camp of Rashidiya, south of Tyre, firing from helicopter gunships. Hezbollah has promised further attacks and threatened a holy war on the Jewish state. For National Public Radio, this is Hillary Brown in Jerusalem.
A day before a Middle Eastern peace conference gets underway in Madrid, President Bush and Soviet leader Gorbachev held talks. At a joint news conference, Mr. Bush said that he and the Soviet president had agreed on new arms control meetings in the wake of cutbacks announced earlier. The Soviet president said that the two nations will take an active role in the Middle Eastern peace conference and use all remedies at their disposal to find a way for peace in the region. During more than 2 hours of talks, food aid for Moscow was discussed, with no plans announced. In Washington, the Environmental Protection Agency has announced new rules designed to reduce pollution that causes acid rain. These regulations are part of the Clean Air Act signed into law by President Bush last year. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
EPA Administrator William Riley announced the regulations today, saying they will break new ground in harnessing the power of the marketplace to improve the environment. That's the Bush administration's approach to a number of environmental problems. This plan involves a market-run incentive system to reduce sulfur dioxide emissions from the nation's utilities. Under the Clean Air Act, there's a cap on how much sulfur dioxide, the pollutant responsible for acid rain, a utility can emit. But each utility can do what it wants to meet the cap and go even further and earn credits it can sell or trade. Instead of profits, the Environmental Defense Fund says, these market mechanisms will be working to clean up the environment. The plan, however, will not cover the nation's biggest power plants until 1995. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 16 points to close at 3,061.94 in very active trading. This is NPR News. Caught between hard economic times and more demands from the federal government, state officials say that educational and highway funding is in trouble. The National Governors Association says that 1992 is going to be a very difficult year for states, perhaps the most difficult in the last 10 years. In addition, states have raised taxes by $25 billion and cut spending by more than $10 billion during the last budget period. Medicaid spending grew by more than 20% during the 1991 budget year. And a spokesman for the National Governors Association says that getting a handle on cost will require some type of national health care program. In Poland, President Lech Wałęsa has indicated that he might double as prime minister in a new coalition government. Elections over the weekend produced no clear winners, and Polish leaders are concerned the next government could be unstable. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from Warsaw.
Lech Wałęsa has long argued that Poland needs strong executive leadership. Sunday's elections, which raised prospects for a badly fragmented parliament, only reinforced his opinion. The task of forming a stable governing coalition is certain to be difficult. In a statement released through his press secretary, Wałęsa suggested one solution would be a government formed by all the parties that trace their roots to the old Solidarity movement. But some of those parties are now bitter enemies, and they may be reluctant to cooperate. An alternative, Wałęsa said, would be for him to lead a government himself in a dual role as president and prime minister. Wałęsa's suggestion will probably be received coolly by critics who already think he has a tendency to act like a dictator. But with Poland now facing the prospect of chaos and instability, Wałęsa's offer can hardly be ruled out. I'm Tom Gelton in Warsaw.
In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against other foreign currencies. Gold prices were little changed. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The music we're listening to now is a Fresh Air favorite. We play it a lot on the show between segments. It's from an album called Bob's Gallery by the Dutch big band The Willem Bruyker Collectief. The band's currently on an American tour. The Collectief's popularity here extends beyond jazz fans and critics who follow the European music scene. A little later on the show, we'll talk with Willem Bruyker. But first, an introduction to the group and some of its recent music from a big Bruyker fan, our jazz critic Evan Whitehead.
As everybody always points out about the Willem Bruyker Collectief, you have to see this 10-piece Dutch band to appreciate how entertaining it can be. Its roots are in music hall comedy, or vaudeville if you prefer, which lasted longer on the other side of the Atlantic than it did over here. If you've ever seen the Benny Hill show, you know what I mean. Bruyker's concerts are heavy on visual shtick. He might pretend he's suddenly forgotten how to play the saxophone, or banish some errant musician from the stage, or go down into the audience to polish somebody's shoes. Look up zany in the dictionary, they got his picture. The theatrical traditions close to the surface of Willem Bruyker's act run deep in his music as well. One key influence on his development was Kurt Weill's theater music, with its oompa rhythms, broadly expressive gestures, and echoes of early jazz. On the Collectif's most recent record, Parade, Bruyker pays tribute to a couple of sources. The album includes his arrangement of Weill's 1936 Aggie's Sewing Machine song. On the album Parade, the Collectif is joined by the 8-piece Mondrian Strings. Their presence underscores the theater orchestra trappings in Bruyker's music. The title suite on Parade was composed by Erik Satie for a 1917 ballet with a libretto by Jean Cocteau. Satie's mix of highbrow writing and lowbrow sound effects, and his abrupt transitions, anticipate some of Bruyker's stuff. They also pointed the way for Carl Stalling's cartoon music. Thank you. The album Parade seems almost scholarly compared to some other Broker records, but he's always paid close attention to his sources. One reason his funny pieces are funny is that he really understands the stuff he parodies, whether it's hot jazz or the movie music of India. The saxophonists play that on electronic horns. Broker learned to yodel to do a cowboy song on the new album, but he's not too concerned with sounding authentic. I began by saying you have to see the Willem Broker Collectief to know how funny they can be. But the humor would be hollow if the music didn't stand up as music. All kidding included, this is a terrific band.
Kevin Whitehead is a freelance writer based in New York. We'll be back after this short break to talk with Willem Broker. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Willem Broker, is founder of the Willem Broker Collectief, the Dutch big band currently on tour in this country. Broker started playing music professionally in Amsterdam in the 1960s. If the music was unconventional, so were the venues where he performed.
I like to change the places where the music always happens. So, let's say in concert halls or small jazz clubs or in cellars. So one of the reasons I did something different, that I like to play at that time, for instance, in the streets, and to bring our music, our ideas about music, to bring it direct to the people, you know, so that they didn't have to come to us, but we came over to them.
Give me a sense of what one of your street concerts might have been like.
Oh, yeah, you can do a lot of things. I mean, the best acoustics are always the streets for me. But you also can put on some theater, and you can do parades, and you can react immediately on situations in the streets and the way people are reacting on your music. And you can stop it, you can go on, and it's a very open situation. So I think we learned a lot about in direct confrontation with the people. And we also went over to strikes and to movements by the ladies that time. And there was a lot to do in Amsterdam and in Holland at that time.
Oh, you mean you'd play where there was a strike or a
yes.
Women's movement rally?
Exactly, yeah.
You know the kinds of antics that you do on stage now? Mm-hmm. What was the original inspiration for that? How did you start doing that?
Well, when I play music or I am on stage, then I'm also a visitor at the same time. So I watch myself, what I'm doing. And when I go to a concert after, let's say, half an hour or 45 minutes, maybe even earlier, then it's very boring to be in a concert hall. For the first place, you have to sit there in a row of chairs. And everybody is doing his job, but nothing is happening. So at that time, I also watch to other things. So for instance, you watch what kind of lamps are in the hall, or what kind of chairs they have, or what kind of people, what kind of clothes they wear, and special things, if their shoes are nice, polished. And that's not so good, I mean, for me, for instance, because I'm not listening to the music anymore, but I'm watching and I'm looking for other things. So maybe that was one of the reasons that I started to do some theater on stage. On the other hand, You can say with theater so many things.
Seems to me you take a very intellectual approach to fun and to slapstick.
Maybe, I don't know. I mean, you only can work with your intellect, and if you don't have it, then it's a pity. But I think you have to think every day about what you are doing and what you are not doing. And I mean music and doing the things I'm doing. It's my profession, so I'm thinking the whole day of it, and there is no way back, actually.
I'm interested in the collective aspect of the group. In what way is your band a collective?
Well, everybody can say what he wants. I mean, it's a contradictio in terms to put my name in front of a collective. But okay, I can't help it. That's the way it is. I can't help it, but just the way it's already since 18 years. So why to change it if it still works the way it works out now? On the other hand, the collective, yeah, everybody can say what he wants. So on paper, I'm the leader, but it's a very open situation. And on the other hand, it's very important for me that everybody earns the same, so inclusive me. Collective means also that everybody feels in a certain way happy in what he is doing. So it's not a situation of boss and people who has to do what somebody says. So that's maybe also the reason that the still five members of the band are with us since the beginning, so since 18 years. And the other, they are already 10 years with us, you know. So that says something about the name Collective.
My guest is Dutch composer, saxophonist, and band leader Willem Breuker. More in just 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. So, Linda, you're taking the temperature of the economy today?
That's right, Terry. And we have good news and bad news. The gross national product is up, and the deficit is going to hit record heights this year. We'll be trying to find out what all of that sits down to. We're also going to be looking at the Middle East Peace Conference, which is due to start tomorrow. We'll have the view from Madrid from Silvia Poggioli, and my colleague Robert Siegel is in Israel and will be reporting from Gaza. There's also a vote today on the civil rights bill. We'll have a report on that, too.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Dutch composer, saxophonist, and band leader Willem Breuker. What kind of music did you hear that really reached you when you were growing up in Amsterdam in the 1940s and 50s?
Well, there was some music by, most of the time it was just music from the classical side, from the written down side, the composer's music. But what I remember that I was really shocked when I was, let's say, about 12 years old, and after school time, I went to the music library, and I heard for the first time music by Edgar Varèse, so the French-American composer. And that shocked me really, you know, that I couldn't imagine that that type of music really was there. When I heard for the first time a string quartet by Arnold Schoenberg, for instance, the same shock.
Now, you're basically talking about classical composers and 20th century classical composers, but I would have thought you'd also have heard a lot of circus music and parade bands when you were young.
Well, I'm coming from a labor part of Amsterdam, so we had a lot of marching bands in the street. But I think that aspect of music came up later in my music. I was a very serious guy, actually, more interested in what I told you already. But I was also very shocked by, let's say, the Duke Ellington Band or the Basie Band or also Louis Armstrong, you know. I mean, there are two types of music, good and bad music. So, and it has nothing to do with style, I think. So, well, it was hard for me to make a good choice, actually. And there was so much music that time. And I spent all my money on buying records and things like that to get information.
Were most of the records you bought classical records, or were you getting a lot of jazz records too?
Yeah, the same. So I could buy a record by Basie and also a record by Varèse, for instance. You know, no problem at all. So it was also a very strange situation in my home place because nobody understood really what I had in mind with that music.
Did you listen to rock and roll or even movie music?
Rock and roll. Yeah, it was the time that Elvis Presley came up and Little Richard and later on the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And well, I was only surprised by the singing of Elvis Presley, actually, because I think he was a marvelous, fantastic singer. But the rest I was not so interested in.
So what led you from classical music, which is what your background was in, to a form of jazz where you include everything you want to in it, but still it's more jazz than classical?
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that I was a very bad student, actually, in music, because I didn't like to rehearse and to play what other people had written down for me. So when I had to study my clarinet lessons, I was too lazy to turn the page to the next piece, you know. So then I started on improvising. And just the thing I like in music, to improvise. But on the other hand, if you improvise a lot, maybe you like to, after a while, you like to write it down and that you know what you have done, for instance. And then you always can you close periods behind you. That's the reason why I make records and CDs, you know, because you close periods. And then you can go on.
Let me ask you about your composition on your latest album, the album Parade.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit what you were working on conceptually in your composition, which is, you pronounce it for me, I can't really pronounce this.
How do you want to pronounce it?
I'd pronounce it Zans Pigels.
Fantastic.
Yeah, you like that?
Yes, very good. You know what it means?
No, I have no idea what it means.
Oh, it has to do with money. We got, last year, November, I think, we got a prize by the Zaanse Stichting. And Zaandam, that's a city in the north of Amsterdam, 20 kilometers in the north of Amsterdam. And I wrote a piece. It's about money. So if you get money, you can do something. If you have no money, you can do nothing. And it's also a song in the... I think it's humoristic, actually. But it's also a little bit... it's not too nice to them, actually, where the song is about. So it's not going on your knees and saying, thank you very much for what you did to us, but also a little bit with an eye wink, thank you, but it's enough now.
Whiskey, you never could all make a goose. Dus wat
Did you ever feel that certain serious music listeners weren't going to take your group so seriously because your music was fun?
Yeah, sometimes they go away, and sometimes they stay, and most of the time they stay, I better can say that. So we lately saw it in Vienna, for instance, a couple of weeks ago, that there were very old ladies sitting in the audience. In the first 10 minutes, they were really shocked about the music we did. But then after a while, they started to understand it, what we were doing. And they had a fantastic night, and they came after the concert, came over to us. And that was the first experience they had in their life with music. They didn't know that it existed at all. And we had the same experiences in England, for instance. We played a concert in Oxford in May this year, and people actually were crying, coming up to us and saying, "This is impossible. I once dreamt about music like that, but it really exists." So, I mean, that's an answer on something, you know.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you too.
The Willem Breuker Collectif is on an American tour over the next few weeks. It's taking them to Rochester, Buffalo, Cambridge, Louisville, Chicago, Washington, Seattle, San Francisco, and Portland. The Collectif's latest album is Parade. And if you want the spelling of Breuker's name, it's B-R-E-U-K-E-R. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tuohy, with Roberta Shurrock and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as the Middle East Peace Conference opens, we ask Roger Fisher of the Harvard Negotiation Project for his assessment of how to reach an agreement between the Arabs and Israelis. Also, James Reston looks back on his half century at the New York Times as reporter, columnist, and executive editor. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.